Наконец-то в Сирии перемирие.
К войне действует... России против Украины.
И пока Москва пытается потушить сирийский конфликт...
Силы Путина базируются
будет
на
слабости. Бомбить в Сирии, а потом будет бомбить Украину.
Почему Россия спасает не Украину, а Сирию?
A funny thing happened when the shaky ceasefire Russia and the United States negotiated kicked in this week in Syria. Moscow began re-escalating the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Pro-Moscow separatists increased their attacks near Luhansk, intensified their shelling of four villages in the Donetsk region, and moved 88 tanks up to the ceasefire line near Debaltseve. It was as cynical as it was predictable, and it illustrates that Moscow is fighting one war with the West, albeit on two fronts. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is Michael Weiss, senior editor at the Daily Beast and co-author of the best-selling book, ISIS, Inside the Army of Terror, a new edition of which was just published. Congratulations and welcome back, Michael. Always great to have you on.
Thanks, Brian. Great to be on.
And also joining us from Kyiv, also via Skype, is Andreas Umland, a senior research fellow at the Institute for Euro-Atlantic Cooperation and the editor of the academic book series Soviet and Post-Soviet Politics and Society. Welcome back, Andreas. Always good to see you, too.
Hello, Brian.
And joining us from London via Skype is Kadri Leek, a senior research fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome to the podcast, Kadri. I've long been an admirer of your excellent work and have long wanted to get you on. Glad we could finally make it happen.
My pleasure.
My pleasure, too. And Kadri, we got a tradition here. First time on the podcast, you get the first question. So we'll start with you. And it's convenient because in a recent article you wrote, Russia at the Gates of Aleppo, you made two points that I think really get to the heart of things. I'm going to quote you to you right now. The first quote is, the Russian president wants to win the ideological debate with the West by showing that democratic regime changes and humanitarian intervention sow chaos, and that supporting, quote unquote, legitimate regimes can be a way of resolving crises more fruitfully. You also wrote that Russia's grand strategy in Syria remains the same as it has been since the intervention started. Moscow's aim is to arrive at a negotiated settlement, the terms of which would be dictated by the Syrian regime in Moscow, leaving the moderate opposition and the West with no choice but to accept them, however reluctantly. You wrote these things about Syria, but what came into my mind as I was reading your article was that they both could have just as easily been written about Ukraine. And so I got started out with the big picture here. Is Putin fighting one war on two fronts? Is there a grand unified strategy here? And if so, what's the end game?
Well, I'm not sure to what extent the series two wars has linked. I mean, on one level, they clearly are, as both are about the world order, rules of the game in the world. But at the same time, I think Russia has pretty concrete and different aims in Syria and in Ukraine. Another big difference between the two places is that Russia started its intervention in Syria on the basis of wrong understanding of realities. Sorry, in Ukraine. But in Syria, it was vice versa. They understand Syria quite well and they get Ukraine wrong. They thought that all the Russians in eastern Ukraine will side with Moscow, etc. So it was a flawed understanding. But now still they are trying to make the most of it. And I think they have not given up on their aim of, yes, imposing their conditions of settlement upon us in Ukraine as well as in Syria. But I think the difference is that in Syria, they are likely to succeed. Mm. In Ukraine, it depends a lot on the West and above all on Kyiv. Because really, Kyiv is the most important indicator here. For as long as Russians can hope that Ukraine will fail as a state, it will be back to its usual messy state, the West will get tired, and that opens up another opportunity for Moscow. Until that hope is there, they have no incentive to settle for a face-saving way out, which otherwise I think we would be in the position to offer them and probably should offer them. But that requires Moscow to understand that really by continuing, there is not much to be gained. Mm. And it seems to me they are not there yet.
I mean, I'm a little concerned, judging from the news in recent weeks, that they are getting there, because the West does seem to be getting tired. I mean, I saw when the foreign ministers of Germany and France went to Kyiv, they chose to lecture the Ukrainian government about not passing a law on elections in the occupied territories. The French and German foreign ministers seem to be equating Russia's violations on the battlefield with Ukraine's inability to pass a very difficult electoral law in a democratic system in a war zone. And I think this gets me to think that the West is getting tired and is beginning to blame this on Ukraine. And I think Russia does believe time's on its side here just as much as it is in Syria.
I wouldn't view it quite as dramatically. I mean, the West is getting tired with Ukraine's inability to reform the way that is needed. And I think that really, the activities of Kyiv leave much to be desired. As concerns the Minsk agreement, I mean, everyone knows that this is nearly unimplementable. It poses pretty impossible conditions to Ukraine, as on one level to Russia, because Russia clearly it does not agree to lose to Ukraine. I mean, they deserve to. But they are unlikely to leave Donbass and leave it all to Kyiv. And that's where I think the West ought to invest more diplomatic energy in order to make this admittedly extremely bad agreement into something remotely implementable by both sides. But for that, the crucial condition really is whether Moscow is willing to give up on its demand to have some sort of legal leverage over Kyiv's future decision-making. Mm. You know, some sort of veto powers for Donbass that then Moscow could use to its advantage. Because that is something that Kyiv clearly cannot swallow. And the West, I hope we cannot, we certainly should not swallow. And that's what creates the deadlock. If Moscow gave up on that demand, then the rest of it, the choreography, the elections, everything, that I think can be arranged. Another question is whether there will be will, because that would require lots of diplomatic energy. And given how overstretched we are on all other fronts, I'm not sure we are willing to invest that sort of effort. But we should.
Yeah, no, I agree we should, but I think that Moscow understands that we probably won't. Michael, let's go to you. I mean, looking at these two, going back to the original question here, these two wars kind of in tandem, do you see them fitting together? Do you see a grand strategy? Do you see, as I laid out in the intro, one war on two fronts?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I quite agree that there are different objectives with respect to Ukraine and Syria, but the broader theme, if you like, is the same. And it has always been, you know, create a problem and then present yourself as the indispensable partner in trying to resolve it, right? So with respect to Syria, you know, the U.S. had this very schizophrenic, ambivalent policy from day one. Assad must go, but we're not really going to do anything that could facilitate his ouster in the military level. There has been some arming of, you know, CIA-vetted rebel groups. But by and large, Brian, I mean, if you look at the lay of the land, the U.S. is objectively aligned with the interests of the regime. I mean, we're going after ISIS. We have deconflicted from Russia's campaign, which is, despite what the Kremlin said it was going to be, has been targeting the Syrian opposition, both mainstream and not so mainstream. And I quite agree that the goal there is to force a diplomatic or political settlement that is most favorable to Moscow, which is to say the maintenance of the Assad regime. Now, you know, there's been a lot of chatter about whether or not Putin has kind of had it with Bashar al-Assad himself, and he wants him to go and perhaps put in place another kind of, you know, strongman figure. But essentially, you would have in that eventuality Assadism without Assad, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it would not be much of a transition. And the U.S. has kind of indicated from the very beginning that this is kind of sort of okay. I mean, the phrases that keep coming up at the executive level, you know, the maintenance of quote-unquote state institutions in Syria. Well, these are the state institutions that the U.S. State Department also alleges have committed war crimes on a scale unseen since the Holocaust, right? The latest line that you hear is preserving or respecting, quote, Iranian equities. Well, Iranian equities are essentially allowing the Revolutionary Guard Corps to prop up their regime and to create what is not even so much a deep state anymore, in the sense that, you know, what you see in Iraq or through Hezbollah in neighboring Lebanon, but really the state. You know, I mean, without Qasem Soleimani, Assad is toast. And it's indeed the Iranian proxy groups and the militias that have been built both at the domestic level and the foreign level. I mean, they've brought in Afghans, you know, Afghan refugees who have moved to Iran. They've seconded them as mercenary forces. These are the elements that are fighting the most contentious battle for Aleppo right now, which is the Stalingrad of the Syrian revolution. With respect to Ukraine, you know, look, in last summer, everyone, myself included, thought there was going to be another major escalation. And to some extent there was. You saw the mobilization of new weapons units, thermobaric bombs and all the rest of it. But instead, Putin went to Syria, and he did it in a fashion. You know, this wasn't Maskarovka warfare in the classical sense. But remember, there was that whole period in the summer, in late August, early September, of plausible deniability, right? You know, the creeping intervention that never was. And, you know, you know that I read the sort of tea leaves of Kremlin disinformation very carefully. And it was deny, and shriek and howl that anything untoward is going on. You know, of course, we already have a naval base or a naval resupply center at Tartus, so this is all just, you know, big storm and drying over nothing. Well, no, I mean, Putin now has a major air base and, you know, on the Mediterranean, and he's looking to expand his reach in the Middle East such that whenever you need any kind of business to be done, be it the Saudis looking to cut some kind of deal over Israel-Palestine, or the Saudis looking to try and contain or tamp down Iranian hegemony in the region, you go to Moscow first, not Washington. Mm-hmm. Now, they're not there yet. You know, I mean, you can be very hyperbolic about, you know, the success with which Russian sort of great power has returned. But we are beginning to see, you know, signs of this. And, you know, I have to say, the U.S., you know, although at the rhetorical level, it's quite worrisome, at the policy level, we seem to be more accommodating this, you know, sort of regional realignment rather than trying to contain or rebut it. Evelyn Farkas, who was the chief Pentagon official tasked with you know, considering and planning for the Russian military and geopolitical threat, resigned because she thought that policy just was not matching at least the stated goals of U.S. national security. So I think, you know, in many respects, Russia will be successful in Syria. We're already there. I mean, look at this ceasefire, right? And this is the great sort of double bind that they get us in. You know, they escalate or they underwrite a war, making it so messy and so difficult that the United States kind of wants to wash its hands of it, right? We want to settle it. We want to sort of negotiate some kind of, you know, peaceful settlement. But at the end of the day, we have to do a deal with the Kremlin. Then, as a ceasefire has been inaugurated, it's serially violated from day one. Mm-hmm. Now, it's true that Russian sorties have lessened to a dramatic extent, such that the skies above, you know, above Aleppo are clear on, you know, most hours of the day, and the protest movements have come back. But there are ceasefires, and the regime has waged a ground offensive in Latakia and the Gob Plain, which is very strategically important for carving out what could be a kind of end goal or end state of all of this, which is the Balkanization of the country, broadly speaking, along ethno-sectarian lines. You know, Alawistan belonging to Assad, fortified and underwritten by Russian hard power, the ISIS sort of, you know, no man's land, which the international community will have to deal with. And then two separate Sunnistans, one in the north where the Turks have the greatest purchase, and then one in the south in Deraa province and Kanitra, which the Jordanians will have to oversee. Now, this is actually something that was put forward by Phil Gordon, you know, one of the White House's top advisors on Middle East strategy until his resignation. And I think this is actually where we're headed with respect to
this
Syria.
Is the big plan B everybody's talking about?
The plan B, right, yeah. Which, you know, I mean, if you know your history of the Middle East, whatever Western powers get together to carve up states, it doesn't end so tidily and so well. It usually gives rise to other epiphenomena, including, you know, more civil war and then more regional war.
Right. Now, I on a blog post this morning, kind of previewing this podcast, I made an argument. I made my argument that basically this is one war on two fronts, and that basically there's kind of three interrelated goals here. One, as you noted in your piece, Cutter, is kind of anti-revolutionaryism, I guess is what you can call it. The belief that Putin basically conflated the colored revolutions in the former Soviet Union with the Arab Spring as if these are one thing, and that revolution, democratic revolution, always leads to chaos, and therefore we should support dictators, I guess. Making the world safe for dictators is the way I tried to glibly put it. That's number one. Number two is basically returning Russia to the ranks of great powers. This is, I think, one of the underlying things of both the Ukraine and the Syrian conflicts. And third is basically getting that sphere of influence in the former Soviet space that Russia really covets. All these three things are interrelated. To get the sphere of influence, you have to be a great power. To be a great power, you have to stop revolutions on your doorstep. So Russia needs both of these things. It needs to win in Ukraine, and it needs to win in Syria. And I think they're going to this kind of seesawing between these two conflicts is what we're seeing now. Andreas, what are your thoughts? Would you agree with that, or what do you see as an overarching goal here?
Yes, I'll agree. I would just add that apart from these geopolitical games, I think what is the deeper reason for all this engagement of Russia on the world, in the world theater, so to say, is the political regime that is now under stress, which cannot legitimize itself any longer with socioeconomic success, and which is now looking for other legitimation modes. And perhaps in a different world, when the regime could still give out larger salaries, larger pensions, and so on, it wouldn't be as aggressive as it is now. Therefore, I'm also a little bit pessimistic on the future. I think that there will be no real settlement. My fear is, for instance, that this current escalation that we had with Syria may be a kind of conditioning of the Russian public for a larger military engagement of Russia, of regular Russian forces in Ukraine, so that sort of the Russian public is getting used to seeing the Russian army being active, and maybe it can be then also persuaded that the Russian army should get into Ukraine. I think the main audience for this Russian deception tactic or the denial of Russian engagement in Ukraine was the domestic audience, actually, and less so the international sphere. So I fear that the regime will continue to do these things just to distract the Russian public from the domestic problems and to have explanations why things are not going well in the economy, and why the social standards are declining. And I would agree with Kadri that the West has to exert pressure on Russia, that the price for this further military escalation, whether in Ukraine or in Syria or somewhere else, will be so high that it would be then less risky for the Kremlin to not escalate and to actually try some settlement, because the price for further escalation would be too high. So that's my interpretation. Right. I would very much focus on the sort of the private needs and interests of the power holders, because from a Russian national interest point of view, I think none of that makes sense. It's a total overstretch for Russia. It creates lots of problems, lots of enemies for Russia around the world, in the Arabic world. Now with this confrontation with Turkey in Eastern Europe and so on. So I think the at the end of the day, it's all about a few very rich men in Moscow who want to preserve their privileges and power as long as possible.
No, you make a good point, Andreas, and this is a point that Vladimir Frolov, one of the sharper Russian observers of foreign affairs and somebody who has been a frequent guest in this podcast, always makes. Putin cannot afford a foreign policy defeat. Anything perceived as a foreign policy defeat would be domestic political death for him. Therefore, he must just keep escalating. He has to keep these wars going, regardless of whether or not they're in Russia's national interest. Kadri, would you agree with that assessment?
Yes, I think it is true that the political system has an incentive to fuel that feeling of uncertainty among Russian population that would make them to cling to Putin, because it's uncontested environment. They have nothing except Putin in terms of governments or policy making. So I think Putin's popularity ratings for a long time, they don't really indicate his real popularity, but they indicate something, and that is, in my view, the level of uncertainty that people feel. So I've compared it somewhere with a life raft in a stormy sea. You know, it doesn't matter whether you like it or not. That's the only thing you have. And when sea is rough, you cling to it very strongly. When it's a little less rough, you cling a little less. And so there is incentive to keep them clinging. And that's why you cannot really allow sort of very relaxed environment to emerge. At the same time, looking at the sort of at these things from foreign policy perspective, to be honest, I have never thought that they will go deeper into Ukrainian territory. I do not think that is something they need. And by now they have seen that this is not such an easy and smooth ride either.
Even if they can get like Mariupol, Kharkiv, that strip, they wouldn't like that if they thought they can get it.
But why would they do that? I mean, they want control over Kiev's decision making, not Kharkiv as Kharkiv. Going to Kharkiv will actually get them further from that hole of controlling Kiev rather than closer.
So, they love a land bridge to Crimea.
Yeah, but you know, that would mean they will have lost Kiev forever. Sanctions will stay forever. The whole West will sort of raise up to oppose Russia. So
you have more faith in the West resolve than I do.
Yeah, I mean,
but anyway, I think there is more to lose than to win. Whereas control over Kiev's decision making might seem to them achievable via the Minsk agreement. So. To be honest, I didn't think escalation would happen also last summer. I mean, I could see, yeah, many people feared, and there seemed to be some armaments being transported, etc. But politically, I never saw the rationale for it. So I wasn't surprised at all that it didn't happen. And I think they are trying to get what can be got politically. And they are trying to make use of the last months of Obama administration, because they fear a little bit of what might come next in Washington.
Yeah, no, I think you're right there. Michael, you indicated that you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, well, I mean, we ran a piece yesterday at The Interpreter, which I found fascinating, about, you know, both sides in the Ukraine ceasefire that never was are lying about the extent of the violations. So in other words, there's much more violence. It's not just been this week, by the way. This has been ongoing for months. And if you look at the OSCE Monitoring Mission weekly reports, I mean, for instance, I think this week alone, or in the last whatever period it was, you know, you had roughly Kyiv and the pro-Russian separatists were estimating about 80 violations. Now, of course, they assign blame differently, as you might expect. The OSCE said it's more like 800. I mean, an order of magnitude higher. So here's what I see kind of transpiring. You know, we have these kind of fake armistices in place. Moscow tests the boundaries, right? I mean, it was sort of a pinprick sort of gambit at the demarcation point in Donbass. There have been attacks going on. Last summer, we did see a big escalation in Marinka, right? I mean, it was the worst spate of violence we had seen in about a year's time. That just kind of got hushed up or underreported because it wasn't the quote-unquote invasion we were all, or some of us anyway, were anticipating. But I could see a situation whereby, and this kind of comes back to the point I alluded to earlier, once the West is locked into ensuring that some kind of settlement or some kind of diplomatic accord has to be seen through, even if it's torn up every single day. Once it is locked in that, Russia can almost do what it likes under the impunity and the cover of Western sanction. And this is what you're seeing now in Syria. I mean, just to give you a sense of the absurdity of this, Brian, I mean, there's been a report in a website called Syria Direct querying people on the ground about ceasefire violations and how they've gone about reporting them. And the mechanism that's set up is a hotline run by the State Department. So, you know, if Russians, a fighter jet, a Russian attack jet or a Syrian attack jet bombs your town, call 1-800, you know, violate and report it. And I mean, this is something, it reads like something out of The Onion, because, you know, the Arabs who are putting in the call say that the guys on the other end of the line don't speak Arabic. I mean, they're using the Arabic word for Pepsi to sort of say, yeah, we got it. I mean, so I see this as, you know, again, you know, heads I win, tails you lose kind of scenario, or the double bind, which, you know, we've talked about before on this show, is kind of a classic piece of Chekhov's tradecraft, right? You know, reflexive control, making your enemy do that
exactly.
which
not and this is what we're going to talk about in the second half.
And that is what I can. Now, as far as a land bridge, and look, I mean, why can't Russia have both? Why can't they control Kyiv at the political and, by the way, at the economic level, which is something, I mean, you know, given the corruption and given the, you know, the prospects of Maidan 2 and the kind of political dysfunction we're now seeing at the Ukrainian government level, we don't know the full extent of Russian infiltration or Russian subversion that's taking place. I mean, this would be going back to the classic 2004 period. At the same time, a military escalation, again, under the cover of Minsk 2 is holding, could be very plausible. Now, at some point, Germany, Brussels, Washington have to wake up and say, look, this is ridiculous. I mean, you're pushing ahead while you're meant to be kind of holding your occupied territory and abiding by the ceasefire. But it doesn't happen in sort of one major onslaught overnight, does it? It's a drip-drip effect. So, and I've seen, and we've covered and analyzed sort of the war, again, going over the past few months. The boundaries, particularly around Mariupol, have been tested and tested almost to the breaking point. So it is very plausible to my mind to see total political collapse or some kind of major calamity occurring in the capital, in Kyiv, and in the east, all of a sudden you see the tanks roll in. And again, Russia's not at war in Ukraine, right? This has been the fiction maintained from day one. This has nothing to do with the Russian military. There are no conventional soldiers. There's no GRU. There's no Spetsnaz. So if the volunteers or the separatists decide to push ahead, well, you know, it's to protect the ethnic Russian minority because Kyiv is now being overrun by oligarchs and fascists. I mean, I don't know. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, everybody on the line, but this would seem to be in keeping with a script that we've seen played out over the last 18 months, 2 years. I mean, so, you know, anything could happen, and I think we have to be on guard for that.
Kadri, you wanted to jump in, and I want to go to Andreas because he has the benefit of being in Ukraine, but go ahead, Kadri.
No, I actually, my impression is that Moscow has given up on Ukrainian politicians. They don't like them. They don't trust them, any of them. Even, I mean, their experience with Yanukovych was anything but a success story. And that's why if you look at what they probably have wanted since the fall of Yanukovych in February 2014, that is some sort of co-management of the country with the West. In the first months, there were not so subtle hints that let's carve up the country. You will get the West, we will get the East. Restatements were often uttered through personalities such as Zhirinovsky, but they were sort of meant. And people in Moscow, and we went at the time with some who actually had been part of Putin's Ukraine team, and they said, no, we don't want Lviv. What on earth would we do in Lviv, in Western Ukraine? But we are interested in the East, so you can take the West. Then, when we saw that this was not so easy, you know, the rebellion in the East did not really catch fire, even in Donbass. It took a lot of helping to make it into anything. I mean, as Girkin has very explicitly said, and even so, it's problematic. These proxies are not so easy to manage, as Kremlin is seeing. So I don't think they want to go further than that. Plus, I think Poroshenko's election victory was also something convincing. I mean, he got a proper mandate in all of Ukraine, and that was not lost on the Kremlin. So now they are trying differently, a sort of legalistic way, to use that slice of Donbass in order to manipulate constitutional arrangements in
Ukraine. The Trojan horse theory, basically.
Yeah. Well, exactly. But I don't think, you know, Kyiv might be infiltrated, but I don't think Moscow will think again that having their man as president of Ukraine is something they can rely on. And they have had their people. Has it really worked? Not necessarily.
Yeah. No, and Leonid Mershitsky makes the argument they're going to work through the oligarchs. Although the oligarchs in Ukraine are hardly a monolithic group, but work through their oligarchs. It's not clear. Andreas, you have the benefit of actually being in Ukraine. How does this all look to you?
Yeah, I think the function of Ukraine here is that it sort of provides a drama that it's that is distracting the Russian public from the sort of dramatic events that are going on inside Russia. You have this sort of negative example and you want to be unstable. I'm not even so sure that the Russian leadership is totally against or would be that much scared by a sort of defeat. What they would be mainly scared of is a sort of stabilization that would allow the Russian public to refocus on domestic issues. So the drama of the situation could also include defeats and of course victories, as long as there is some drama in it, and it could be certain problems that are arising, and that actually these new problems would be actually good for the regime, because it would then be news that you could feed into the Russian information sphere, and you would have then a new problem that needs to be solved. And so I think what they want is probably Ukraine to be in this unstable situation. And my fear is that if things become more stable inside Ukraine, if the reforms start having an effect, if there is a perception that actually this new Ukrainian state is sort of settling, that it's becoming established and legitimate and so on, that then actually Russia could escalate again. That then they would, and that's what I said before, that they could be now conditioning the Russian public to actually a larger military involvement here. The more stable Ukraine gets, the more Russia has to invest to actually get it into this unstable situation again. So it's a really problematic situation here. And I've wrote that several times before. Of course, this whole conflict with Russia is a huge distraction. It's also used, of course, by the politicians here to distract people in Ukraine from corruption, from reforms, and they always say, yeah, we have this common enemy, let's unite, let's not get into a fight between the state and civil society, between civil society and the oligarchs. We all have, you know, we have to have this fortress mentality. So, and I think the that's actually something that is intended by the Kremlin, because it keeps the reforms from being effective. Mm-hmm. And and I think Russia will sort of keep that going as long as it can.
No, I think you're right there, Andreas. I mean, I think that what the Kremlin fears most of all is a successful Ukraine. That's what the Kremlin fears most of all. And when I pointed this anti-revolutionary strategy, part of it is propping up dictators, whether it's Yanukovych or Assad. But when that fails, creating a counter-revolution and chaos and mayhem when you have a successful democratic revolution. There's two sides of the same coin. Kadri, you had something to say. I saw you indicated.
No, I think Moscow just gets Ukraine wrong. They focus on the leaders and think it's a failed country. They don't understand to what extent NGO activists are carrying the day, and also the political process. They are doing their job in a messy way, and it's not as effective as ideally it could be, but still, that's the driving force that's taking the country forward in a pretty chaotic manner, but still. And Moscow completely overlooks it. They cannot see the significance of it. Plus, not many Moscow analysts actually visit Kiev. They don't experience it. They see it via the lenses of Moscow, based on information they receive there. But I wanted to react to something that Andreas said, that drama is what you need. And I think that is entirely true. Not so much even about Ukraine, because, you know, Ukraine, you can just tell whatever about Ukraine on Russian TV, regardless of the circumstances on the ground. But they needed some sort of drama to catch the eyes of the Russian public. And I think that was the lesson they have learned from the Bolotnaya protests and the mess they had in 2011. And that was lack of drama. Putin and Medvedev turning up saying that, you know, Putin will return to presidency, and there was no drama around it, no eye-catching plot, not anything. And that led to protests. I think that's one lesson they have learned, that whatever you do domestically needs to be accompanied with a proper drama to legitimize it.
Oh, God, we need Peter Pomerantsev here now.
I was just thinking that, actually. Can I want to make one point, Brian, if I may. You know, there seems to be a paradox here in terms of, well, what is Russia's long-term strategy with respect to Ukraine? So if we are to assume that they're looking for some kind of constitutional carve-up of the country, you can call it whatever you like, balkanization, decentralization, or a federalist state. That suggests, and it follows from that, that actually you need a stable Ukrainian government to number one, implement that policy, and number two, ensure that the boundaries of this kind of carve-up are maintained, right? The worst thing that could happen if Russia is looking to keep some kind of fief or suzerainty in Donbass is to have Kiev completely collapse and, you know, God forbid the country devolves into some sort of, you know, warlordist state. So this is where I see the contradiction here. Like, what are they really playing at? Now, they can say, Russian officials can tell you, well, we're looking only to sort of keep our share of influence in the capital and, you know, ensure that Ukraine remains in our sphere of influence. But I see these moves and these gestures as kind of working across purposes, right? I mean, if they're looking to destabilize Kyiv, they're also keeping a pretty extensive garrison both at the border and inside Ukrainian territory. If Kyiv gets sufficiently destabilized such that it becomes a failed state, which is what Russian state media says it already is, right? What happens
incorrectly,
then?
Yeah.
Right, exactly. That's when the tanks roll in, right? That's when you fortify what you claim to be your kind of blood and soil compatriots. And again, what is the West's kind of deterrence here? I mean, you know, we're already hearing the EU talking about a return to the status quo ante, where sanctions will be lifted in spite of, as we've just discussed, you know, an uptick in violence and Russian-backed separatists, you know, escalating the war in the east. If sanctions are lifted, who's to stop this kind of grim endgame from occurring? I mean, you're not going to see sanctions re-implemented again, particularly not given the lay of the land in most influential European countries at the moment. So I don't know. I mean, I don't have an answer for this. I'm just posing this as a question.
Yeah. Kadri, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think Moscow views it slightly differently. They think we are responsible for Kyiv. They see Kyiv as our puppet, the West's puppet, and who is obliged to, I mean, you point out very, very right things, that Kyiv needs to accept the settlement on Donbass and follow its terms. But in Russia's view, who is ultimately responsible for Kyiv doing so is not Kyiv, but I don't know, Victoria Nuland, John McCain, Angela Merkel, I mean, people like that. We need to guarantee it because Kyiv now is our puppet. We have taken it, so we need to pay it and guarantee it behaves. So I think that is Moscow's logic, and that is what they are trying to achieve. And I think it's our duty not to accept these terms and make it very clear that we stick to the sanctions until you are ready to back off. And that's going to take some more time.
Yeah, and that's going to take some doing, especially in Brussels. Andreas, I wanted to ask you, as a historian here, I drew the analogy between Putin's policies in Syria and in the former Soviet Union with the Holy Alliance. Basically, the attempts to basically squash any revolutionary activity in Europe after the French Revolution. And it got me thinking along these lines that Russia did quite well after the Napoleonic Wars. The Russian Empire did quite well much like it did quite well after World War II. That's after wars that Russia gains influence in Europe. What are your thoughts on that historical kind of analogy?
Yes, I think that's true to a certain extent, but there is for the Holy Alliance and also for the Soviet Empire, sort of larger Soviet Empire and or Soviet pro-Soviet bloc, worldwide bloc, there was an ideological foundation in both cases. Whereas here, you have these very diverse countries that are culturally very far apart from each other. Mm. So. There was this idea of Mikritrenin of a greater Asia, which would be something, some sort of counter model to the earlier idea of greater Europe. The problem being that these Asian countries that, and Russia would be part of that, they don't have a cultural foundation. It's right. Just, you know, it's just a negative feeling against America right. or the West and so on. But there's nothing deeper that would sustain such a international alliance. It's just based on basically on anti-Americanism, on that these dictators want to preserve their power. But that's not comparable. It reminds me also of Fyodor Tyutchev, who wrote in the late 18th century that, you know, Russia has to be the guarantor of the old system and the guarantor against revolution, and it has to save the European countries from left-wing revolutions. And, you know, he was writing all that, and then what happened was the opposite thing, that Russia suffered from the same revolution he was actually warning against, whereas the European countries, they had been these sort of social democratic movements and far more sort of politically continuous development. So, there is something behind it, but again, I would break it down to the private interests of some super rich people in Moscow who are using all sorts of instruments. It could be China, it could be Iran, it could be some sort of sovereign democracy, whatever. These things have a very functional sort of meaning. I don't think there's anything deeper in it, which is sort of, so I don't think somebody right. like Alexander Dugin is really Putin's brain or something like that. These are just ideas and people and concepts that the Russian leadership is playing with. The risk here, of course, being that the Russian public is really getting infected with all these Manichaean, conspiratorial, dualistic worldviews, and that now the majority of the population thinks in this totally paranoid terms about world politics, that they think that the West is basically after them.
Right. So there's no ideological or values-based underpinning for this new world order that Putin's hoping to. I mean, that's the kind of the big takeaway I'm kind of getting from this discussion here, that the end game of all of this might be some new world order, but there isn't really any there.
You might even call it "Make Russia Great Again," Brian. You know, okay. That's sort of the underpinning
pattern. Okay. That's a good way to segue into the second part. In a few moments, we will continue our discussion and look at some of the other non-kinetic fronts in Putin's war in the West. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is Michael Weiss, senior editor at the Daily Beast and editor of the Interpreter magazine and the co-author of the best-selling book ISIS Inside the Army of Terror. Also joining us from Kiev is Andreas Umland, a senior research fellow at the Institute for Euro-Atlantic Cooperation and editor of the academic book series Soviet and Post-Soviet Politics and Society. And joining us from London, making her first but hopefully not last appearance on the podcast, is Kadri Leek, a senior fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Ряд европейских СМИ разжигает информационную войну.
У Белого дома нет плана для Сирии. В его стенах
дезинформации. Он
кричат: ужас, ужас, ужас.
Война идет информационная.
Запад потерпел фиаско в Сирии. Запад.
In recent weeks, many Kremlin watchers, myself included, have become fascinated with a new phrase: reflexive control. It's actually not a new phrase at all. It's actually a decades-old tactic first developed by Soviet military strategists in the 1960s that aims to compel adversaries to behave in a manner advantageous to Moscow. It does this by preemptively shaping the environment through disinformation campaigns, psyops, business ties, political meddling, establishing military facts in the ground, or any combination of these. The idea is to shape the environment in such a way that the enemy chooses Russia's preferred course of action voluntarily because it's the easiest and the other options appear more difficult and risky. Michael, you've been long looking into Russia's use of active measures in Europe. You co-authored a very well received report on Russia's information war. Well, do you see these active measures shaping the environment and by extension shaping decision making in the West in Syria and in Ukraine?
Yeah, I do. I mean, you know, the most kind of banner moment I think in the last 2 months was the fake rape story out of Berlin, right? I mean, this was something Channel One essentially perpetrated. It didn't completely invent the story. There was some, you know, grounds there in terms of, you know, the victim's family members. But, you know, essentially it was designed to show that Germany's policy with respect to receiving so many refugees is leading to, you know, these conquering Arab North African hordes who are going around raping not only German women, but German Russian women. And then, you know, this had a very powerful effect. You saw enormous protests against Angela Merkel outside her political offices in Berlin. This dominated the German headlines, and it didn't matter that from the very beginning the police had said, look, there's no story here. We've investigated it. We've seen, you know, the contents of the young girl's cell phone. We know she stayed with a friend, and this was all to avoid having a row with her parents. Didn't matter. Channel One also, need I remind you, is the news organ that invented the Ukrainian crucifixion story, which people now forget, but was one of the most, I mean, essentially a blood libel, right? You know, leveled at Kyiv about, depending on who you asked, I think with Channel One, it was a 3-year-old boy had been crucified in Slavyansk. And this was picked up by Dugin and other assorted surrogates of the government as evidence that, yeah, everything they'd been saying about the Ukrainian government, it's a fascist junta, you know, with a sort of sanguinary mission to exterminate ethnic Russians from Ukraine was true. My point, you know, with this is that, look, it is absolutely the case that active measures in the 21st century are rather crude and amateurish. But then again, a lot of active measures in the 20th century were also crude and amateurish. And it didn't matter because as long as you can sow enough skepticism and doubt or confuse the quote-unquote truth or the established narrative of a sequence of events or a major controversy, mission accomplished. What makes them more dangerous now is the ease with which they can be disseminated and circulated around the world. So, I mean, in our report that you mentioned, you know, Peter and I talk about with the click of a mouse, you can create a piece of disinformation designed, I mean, this is, you know, the political import of an active measure is designed to weaken the West, right? To vitiate its national interest, and to strengthen, you know, by extension, Russia's, and also to sow discord between and amongst Western allies. So with the click of a mouse, you can accomplish this. And I've given myriad examples in the past, you know, that Ebola was a biological weapon invented by the CIA, more recently with respect to Syria, that the United States is responsible for the creation of ISIS. This is something people don't pay enough attention to, but it's especially deleterious for U.S. policymaking in Iraq or in Turkey or in other Middle Eastern countries. If you go to Baghdad, you hear a lot of particularly Shia Arabs going around saying, yeah, we think ISIS was invented by the United States, not as the unintended consequence of a U.S. invasion in 2003. But this is what the CIA and the Pentagon are really doing. They've created this Sunni jihadist army to combat Iranian influence. Mm-hmm. And look, this is music to the Kremlin's ears, right? Because if Washington is the big bad boogeyman running, you know, stalking the region of the Levant and Mesopotamia, then you need another great power. You need another metropole with which to align. And this comes back to the earlier point I made, which any and all business to be conducted in the contemporary Middle East must run through Moscow. You know, so you had, I think it was the spokesperson for the foreign ministry who had a very evocative line, I thought, and this shows you the success that they have had. You know, yes, it's true. You know, when there's a crisis or there's some kind of revolution or prospective war, the first port of call is Washington, but then Washington calls us to bail them out. That is a marked measure of success right now, because it's true. Russia is seen as the indispensable partner, if not ally. You know, nothing can be accomplished without Sergei Lavrov and John Kerry slapping each other on the back in some Swiss hotel. I mean, that's essentially where we are, right? And it could be Ukraine, it could be Syria, it could be the Iranian nuclear deal. So, you know, I do see this as something that is ongoing. And by the way, I mean, you know, I live in New York. I'm an American. Let's talk about what's happening here. The rise of Donald Trump as a political phenomenon.
We were going to get through this podcast without talking about him, but
well, no, I mean, I have to, Brian, because look, honestly, last night, you know, there was this rather shambolic and jaw-droppingly absurd debate. But what I noticed, you know, on the internet and checking social media, RT, Sputnik, I mean, the Kremlin mouthpiece organs, they love Donald. They love Trump.
Of course they do.
Because Trump is, you know, he has said that he thinks Putin is a decent guy. He can do business with. Putin has praised him. He has disclaimed, you know, Kremlin responsibility for the assassination or the harassment of journalists. This would essentially be America's Berlusconi. And that is great for the Kremlin because, you know, essentially it brings Moscow even more into this kind of regional or global realignment where they are, you know, a superpower in the making again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, active measures here, I mean, God knows what we're going to see in the next few months as the primary season continues. You know, and I think this is something people don't, you know, you're beginning to see at the military and the intelligence levels in the United States a sort of frantic concern about how to combat this stuff. And you hear things about counter-narrative and you know, debunking propaganda. But I don't think people have adequately appreciated the threat value of these things. And again, it's not that, you know, they're sophisticated or elaborate or particularly well thought out. It doesn't matter. If you spend most of your time trying to pick apart or debunk all of the nonsense, that's time that you're not spending doing other things like, you know, trying to preempt or deter an intervention in Syria or, you know, monitoring Narva and the Baltic states from any kind of, you know, separatist style shenanigans there. And this is part of the problem.
Well, the idea behind reflexive control is the information is part of this whole mosaic.
Yeah.
Of anything from establishing military facts on the ground, business ties, lobbying, all of these things designed to shape an environment to get the response you want out of your opponent. Now, Kadri, we were both together at a conference recently in Tartu where this kept coming up again and again and again. The reflexive control was one of the most commonly uttered phrases, I think, from the podium. I know I was guilty of uttering it myself a couple of times, but I know there's other people whose opinions I truly respect. Mark Galeotti, my co-host on this podcast, who's not with us today, and Vladimir Frolov are both very suspicious of this concept. And they see the Kremlin's activities as more ad hoc and chaotic. Kadri, what do you think? Is reflexive control a real thing that is being? I mean, I know it was a real thing in Soviet military history, but is it a real thing today?
Well, it's clearly true that Russia is trying to shape narratives both inside the country and outside, and is sometimes using special measures to create certain impressions here or there. When attempted outside Russia, often these activities actually backfire. If you look at what was being done in Germany, I mean, that has done more to tarnish Russia's image in the eyes of German politicians.
The Lisa case, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Than most other. And if you look what people say in Berlin now, or how personally and emotionally some of them are disappointed, some people who are up to this day trying to find common language for the Kremlin, then, you know, you wonder whether this thing really achieved what it was intended to achieve. But, I mean, I don't deny that these things do take place. Russia is engaging in such activities. But my question is how much really one can achieve with that. Because if I look at Russia's, say, military adventures abroad, and by now we have had three, we have had Georgia, Ukraine, and Syria, and I can see that two of them actually are already interpreted pretty clearly as success stories in Moscow, Georgia and Syria, namely. In Georgia, Moscow managed to stop NATO enlargement. In Syria, it is dictating its terms. Ukraine is more complicated and an Ukraine jury is still out. But basically, in Georgia as well as in Syria, Russia has walked into policy vacuum left by us. And I don't think we should blame Russia for our own policy vacuum. I mean, we have had unthought-through policies in both places. At Bucharest summit, we said that Georgia and Ukraine will become NATO members. That statement was based on no proper unanimity, no proper strategy, no proper negotiation.
It was the subject. Nothing. It was a subject of a compromise that was essentially brokered by the Czech and Polish foreign ministers between the U.S. and Germany, is my understanding of how that.
Well, I'd call that a diplomatic train wreck. I mean, that really was not what we needed, and it has not worked in any productive way. Or on Syria, you know, the West has supported the so-called moderate opposition so that they cannot win and they cannot lose, because some of us probably have had probably well-founded doubts as to whether these people would really be fit to run the country. But we have not really thought of an alternative strategy based on our realization that, you know, they are not fit. So what will we do then? So basically, Russia just walked into a vacuum. And I don't think we should blame Russia for that. We should actually look much more diligently on our own policymaking and try to improve that. Mm.
Andreas, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think I would agree very much with what Kadri said, and that Russia is just seeing these opportunities that it is taking advantage of, and that it is taking advantage of the naivete and so on. The primary example for reflexive control for me would be actually the Minsk agreement. That was basically this extortion that you had an advancing Russian force, and then Putin comes with this text of the Minsk agreement. I think that the main problem with this agreement is the order of the measures given there, so that the closure of the border is actually the last point of the agreement, while it should be actually the first point. You know, that's what it should take. And so this was but Poroshenko was under so much pressure to actually stop the Russian advance, and to, I mean, what he had probably in mind was Russian tanks in Kiev. And so you have then this negotiation, and Merkel is coming, and Hollande, and so on, and so, you know, and either you sign something or you don't. And if you don't sign, maybe you know, Kiev,
you're on your own. Yeah.
And so that was actually the sort of primary. And now everybody's pointing to this Minsk agreement, which was actually a result of extortion, I would say.
Yeah, it was the result. It was. That's exactly how I described it on the Daily Vertical yesterday. It was blackmail. Okay. I think you hit the nail on the head here, Andres. And the perfect victory of reflexive control within the Minsk agreement was the very fact that Moscow got itself recognized as a mediator in a conflict which it was, in fact, the aggressor. The primary and only aggressor. So I think this is an example. So you do see this systematic effort to kind of shape Western responses, or is Russia just getting lucky?
Yeah, but I also agree with Kadri with what she said, that these things, they don't always work the way that that Russia wants them to work. And with the Lisa case, I would even go as far as to say that was actually not something. Meant to be happening in Germany. That was actually the usual story that basically Russian television is telling about the West every day.
Yeah.
And suddenly that catched up with the local Russian German community in Germany. They actually took that for real, and they started these demonstrations. And then I think what may have happened is that the Russian foreign ministry was misinformed by these people, these immigrants from former Soviet Union who were telling the Russian foreign ministry, no, that was really a rape. And then Lavrov came out with a statement.
When Lavrov made that really kicked
off. It's now a big embarrassment, I think, for him, because it's sort of, I think it's more of a problem now for this whole Lisa case, as Kadri said. I mean, I think it went sort of out of control. I'm not even sure that was actually an active measure for the foreign audience. That was something, just the usual propaganda for the domestic audience, and then it sort of had this foreign repercussions. I think what they often try to do is actually is to tell the West a story about Ukraine, for instance, because the West doesn't know much about Ukraine, so they tell all these stories about the fascists and the oligarchs and the putsch and so on. So that's something that they can do, but they cannot tell the Germans what is happening in Germany. Obviously, I mean that is.
But there are still. I mean, if you look at the postmortem on the Lisa case, there are still a lot of ethnic Russians in Germany who believe that this rape took place, just in spite of overwhelming, you know, truth and information to the contrary. And this is the point. I mean, it's not that every single instance or example of an active measure is going to be successful. Again, you know, often these are very cack-handed and clumsily perpetrated, but they are tied to an overall strategy. And I mean, here's, I think, where some of us disagree. I see the strategy very much in keeping with what General Breedlove said this week, which is the refugee crisis in Europe is being weaponized by the Kremlin. And it's being weaponized by the Kremlin, not just in the realm of information warfare or, you know, fake planted stories like this. But look, the bombardment campaign in Syria has exacerbated one of the greatest, if actually the greatest humanitarian catastrophe of the 21st century, where half the country of 23 million people, is either dead, internally displaced, or rendered into a migrant or refugee, living either on a bordering country or now kind of making this desperate play to move to Europe. So these things are inextricable from each other. And, you know, an active measure, it's not just – I mean, we think of propaganda as telling lies. And telling lies almost for this, you know, just to advance a perception of one country or one set of interests as better or less worse than another. But that's not it. I mean, an active measure is it's a form of intelligence tradecraft, right? I mean, it's not just information. It's tied to policy, and it's tied to military policy, and it's tied to geopolitical policy. Mm. And so, you know, again, this was something that, I mean, the fact that a Russian state media organ could control essentially for about almost a fortnight, I think it was, the domestic German conversation or create and control an internal scandal in the most influential country in Europe. It's not to be underestimated. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that it had to be successful. And I don't even know how you would measure success in something like that. I mean, if it were true that Liza had been raped, you know, would this lead to the downfall of Angela Merkel overnight? Well, maybe not. But, you know, Germany is still grappling with, you know, the consequences of what had been an open door policy, right? So I wouldn't discount, you know, the Kremlin's ability to kind of manipulate the European landscape just yet. And also, that's just one country. In Poland now, you know, you see the rise of this sort of demagogic right wing political interest or political movement, which is very much opposed to the influx of any Arab or Muslim, you know, migrant into its country. I mean, you're seeing magazine covers showing, you know, essentially racist imagery, saying, you know, keep out, and Europe is a Christian continent, and we don't want these sort of meddling, subversive elements and interests coming in. And that will only lead to, you know, the further proliferation of political movements, both not just on the right, but also on the left to some extent. Which advocate a withdrawal from the European Union, the dismantlement of Schengen borders, all of which serves whose interest and who stands to gain from that? You know, I don't see these things as so haphazard or ad hoc. I think they do tie into a broader overarching policy. It doesn't mean it's always going to work, but it's still very much a policy to my mind.
Kadri, Andreas, any last thoughts before we wrap it up for the week?
Well, I agree and disagree with Michael. I mean, it's of course Russia makes use of all these things that happen, but I think we should be still quite clear. I mean, Russia didn't launch the refugee flows in the first place. Yes, it may have been manipulated them. Some people from around Aleppo clearly are inspired by Russia's air attacks, etc. But even so, I mean, I think we ought to look more also on our own policies. And if we get our act together and if we get circumstances right, then that will open many fewer opportunities for Moscow. We should not really accuse Moscow of trying to make use of circumstances while pursuing its own aims, even though the latter may be misguided. But they're Moscow's aims for the moment, and we have our aims, and we should pursue ours. Mm-hmm.
Now, that's this reflects something actually that Mark Galeotti said at the Warsaw Security Conference, or the Warsaw Security Forum, where he said basically what Putin does is he holds up a mirror to our own weaknesses And as you point out, Kadri, the good news when that's somebody's strategy is that you can fix that yourself, right? Andreas, very last word to you before we call it a week.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, the active measures are only possible if we are inactive ourselves. Then they open the space for that. And so we have to shape the agenda and not let it Russia do.
All right. Well, that's all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been Michael Weiss, senior editor at The Daily Beast, editor of The Interpreter magazine, and co-author of the best-selling book, ISIS, Inside the Army of Terror. And joining us from Kyiv has been Andreas Umland, a senior research fellow at the Institute for Euro-Atlantic Cooperation and editor of the academic book series Soviet and Post-Soviet Politics and Society. And joining us from London, making her first but hopefully not last appearance on the podcast, has been Kadri Leek, a senior fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks to all for an enlightening discussion.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, whom you can follow on Twitter at Pasha Butorin. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.